Hello everyone and welcome to the BGCP Disassembled Podcast, the official podcast for the Big Glasgow Comic Page, where we talk about the latest comics, movies, television and other places of nerd culture. I'm your host, Massimo Castelli, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Alan, the man who hates everything Todd, especially Zack Snyder properties.
Yeah, nice to meet you. Thank you for having me, and my hate, I don't know what I'm saying anymore, so carry on.
Also, on today's interview special, because we do those now, we are joined by a writer whose credits include Assassin's Creed, Doctor Who The 11th Hour, Volume 3, and has been working on various projects for TKO, Titan and Boom Studios, and also Marvel, and has a one-shot coming out in May, tying in with the Immortal Hulk series called The Immortal Hulk, Time of Monsters. We would like to welcome to the podcast the incomparable Alex Packnadel.
I really thought I was the incompetent.
Incomparable.
Incompetent Alex Packnadel.
Nice to meet you. So just a bit of context, we haven't been talking before this, so this is why at least we've kind of buttered up Alex a little bit. To kind of talk about his various kind of career through comics a little bit, and hopefully we'll be able to kind of get everybody to kind of get on, jump on your work and stuff like that. Hopefully more people will be able to find your amazing work, as I kind of buttered you up earlier on by saying. I think we're just going to jump right into it. So can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, who you are and what you do?
I'm from London. Sorry, I live up in the north of England. I've been writing comics for about 4, maybe 5 years now. Started out sort of straight out of the gates. I did a series for Boom called Arcadia in 2015, and then I did another project with them called Turncoat. Did a year working with Dan Waters on Assassin's Creed Uprising, worked with Rob Williams and Simon Spurrier on Doctor Who for Titan for a while. Done quite a bit of work with Vault Comics. Did a book with them called Friendo, which was a sort of a really kind of unhinged kind of LA set. Sort of black comedy about a guy who goes on a crime spree with his virtual reality assistant. and I did that with Martin Simmons, who's drawing Department of Truth now, which, you know, sold.
We have a big fan of Department of Truth here. Alan's a massive fan.
I think it might have sold some tens of copies.
Oh yeah.
Maybe as many as 20.
Oh, unbelievable, right? Double figures.
Yeah, yes. Remarkable. I've got one out at the moment called Giga, which is a giant mech book, but the conceit is basically they haven't moved in about 300 years, and people live in them and worship them, and one of them gets murdered. That's ongoing right now. I've done some work for Marvel. I did some tie-ins to Empire, the big sort of Marvel event last year. I did one for the big villains. So I did one for the Celestial Messiah and one for Swordsman. They're pretty well received, I think. And I've got an upcoming one. Yeah, as you mentioned, I've got so alongside Immortal Hulk, they do a series of quarterly one shots. So I'm doing one with Juan Ferreira called Immortal Hulk, Time of Monsters. And if you ask me about it, I'll tell you everything I can without getting in trouble.
I think we were going to go for a podcast exclusive, but I guess that's out the window since you can't tell us that much.
Well, no, I'm just half expecting like a sort of Disney-branded shepherd's crook to kind of come around my neck.
Oh man, just like imagine like in the corner, just like off screen, just like a guy in a big mouse ears. Just telling you what you can and can't say.
So I can. What did we tell you?
Oh, just death threats from the House of Mouse. Always fun. So kind of like with that stunning resume out of the way, by the way, might I add, could you maybe tell us how you kind of first got into writing comics and where that kind of maybe that love of comics for like most of us that's kind of become a kind of hobby that's become a passion kind of gestated for you?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. I'll David Copperfield it, but I'll keep it brief.
Oh, don't worry. We love when a guest talk here.
We're holding forth. Yeah. Okay. I'm second generation, really. My dad collected most of just Marvel, really, from about 1972 to 1981. So growing up, you know, he had sort of 4,000 of them stashed away. I've used this sort of comparison elsewhere, but it does the business. It was really, I didn't stand a chance because the problem was if he'd allowed me to read them, I'm sure I would have lost interest, but he didn't. He kept them in a cabinet that was really, really difficult to open. And, you know, I was expressly kind of forbidden from reading them. And it always reminds me of like that Simpsons episode, the Simpsons, yeah, you know, where like Bart's playing with Ralph Wiggum and, you know, they go into like Chief Wiggum's closet to handle his guns and everything. And it's like, you know, Ralphie, you know, how many times have I told you not to look in my forbidden cabinet of mystery? And it was exactly that. So, you know, whenever he left the house, like I used to sort of, you know, like put all these like, because I couldn't even reach the handle, so I used to get all these sort of like Rube Goldberg contraptions, like sort of, you know, like pulling out a tooth with like a piece of string to open the door on this thing. And then, you know, it was like, you know, you're just lost in the kind of chocolate factory.
I mean, it must have been great, like having all that access to comics and stuff like that, like a lot of people probably didn't have in the kind of 70s, if you're saying like the second generation, like having that kind of almost treasure trove that existed that you picked from.
Well, I mean, it's just weird sort of hearing the, I mean, you know, I hope he won't mind me saying this because this does make him look like a bit of a plum. But my dad, he managed to get hold of a copy of Giant Size X-Men 1 from, I think it was like a mate of his had picked it up from Dark They Were and Golden Eye, which was one of the first kind of comic shops in the country. So, you know, specialist comic shops in the country. And a mate of his, because, you know, very few copies were shipped over here. Of Giant Size X-Men 1, and his mate managed to get him one, and it was, you know, like a sort of, it was a pocket money kind of proposition, but I think it was about, you know, bear in mind it's like 1975 or something, and it was about like a tenner or something, so it was like weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks worth of pocket money. Anyway, he had it in his backpack and he was cycling back, and he got hit by a car, right? And check this out, right?
This is
you know, my dad to a T, right? He twisted his body in midair, right? So his body would absorb the brunt of the impact when he smacked into the curb rather than the backpack. So basically, he protected the comic at the expense of his own skeleton. This is like completely fucked up, but the comic was fine.
The idea instead of like the Bible taking the bullet for you, you're taking the bullet for the Bible at that point. That's the
kind just of... like, you know, don't get me wrong. Look, I like comics, right? I like comics, but I have a self-preservation instinct. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, if it's you know. Don't get me wrong, like I have some really nice comics, you know, I have some like quite rare, like Otomo epic stuff, you know, but like if it's between them and me, if it's between the comics and me, the comics are gone. I'm sorry, like I don't want to sustain a break, but yeah, just like his self-preservation instinct just went completely out the window, just absorbed the brunt of this ridiculous thing. Sorry for that digression. So yeah, anyway, I kind of learned to read with him. Do you know what I mean? In the end, so like, he basically, when I was eventually allowed to kind of look at the pretty drawings, you know, he would sort of sit me on his knee and sort of teach me to read with like Marvel Treasury editions and stuff. And you know, it was very, you know, Howard the Duck and Defenders and stuff. Well, Steve Gerber, yeah, man, you know. I mean, every 4-year-old needs to be reading Dr. Bong. So I kind of caught the bug from there. And then when I kind of started getting pocket money, when I turned about, 12 or something, it was just when everything went really, really nuts, because it was when, you know, it was sort of within, I think within a year of that happening, you had like Spider-Man 1, X-Men 1, X-Force 1. So it was, you know, the biggest it's ever been. And, you know, we were living in London at the time. So, like, you know, my dad took me to Forbidden Planet at the same time that X-Men 1 dropped. So, you know, queues around the block and everything, when it was sort of, you know, real rock star sort of stuff. And it was like the old Forbidden Planet. And just kind of got the bug hard, fell into it that way, decided that, I became kind of obsessed with like Liefeld and Jim Lee and those guys. And I remember sort of asking my dad, I was like, so who was the youngest comic writer ever? And I mean, I don't know whether it's true, but he said, oh yeah, well, you know, Jim Shooter was writing Legion of Superheroes at 13. And I was like, right, I'm going to be writing X-Men at 12.
Ooh.
And
big ambitions.
I'm gonna try and get my brain to do a maths now. Come on, brain. I think it finally happened for me 23 years later.
Well, you know what they say, better late than never.
So I didn't end up being the youngest comic writer ever. I think I've managed to be, not the oldest, you know, so it's fine. Did you want to know how I got my first gig? Did you want that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I
was going to ask you, like, you got in like a great time, kind of obviously listening to what you were saying there, like 1990s, that's like when I was kind of reading, like buying my own comics rather than kind of finding them out of bins and stuff. But who were you most into? What was your big book back in the day? Who's your favourite?
I was an X-Books guy up until the late 90s. I mean, just anything X, I used to just hoover it up. And anything not X was kind of lame.
Same.
And then I think I bailed on about sort of Majorera era.
Yeah. Not my thing.
It wasn't that. No, I went to college and I think I kind of thought, well, I also like girls and they probably don't like this. So I capitulated. It turned out that, you know, with or without X-Books, you know, girls weren't interested anyway. So I needn't have bothered.
It would have a different experience because like I'm cut my uni student and stuff. So like for me personally, it's a weird thing to see like almost geek become chic. Like,
this is it.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a very good thing. The geeks won't hurt the air. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's such a weird thing to see, though. Like, as you're saying, like, when you went to, like, uni and stuff like that, or, like, when you were growing up, like, it was that kind of nerdy thing. Like, oh, if you don't play sports or you read comic books, you're a nerd or whatever.
But absolutely self-defeating as well. I mean, like, I mean, I won't name the shop, right? But let's just leave it at it doesn't exist anymore, which I think should tell you everything you need to know. But like, I mean, this is the comic generation that I was in, right? I remember it was just after the Constantine movie had come out, the Keanu Reeves one, right? And I am in a comic shop in a city, and this woman came in, you know, out of a BM, you know, stepped out of a BMW, so, you know, clearly, you know, very successful, walked in, and it was like, you know, the sort of Western saloon, you know, the piano stops, you know,
the games of magic,
heads turn, you know, because it's a woman in it. Yeah, it's a woman in a comic shop. Should we have brought links? Which links?
Africa.
And anyways, like she walked Africa. Oh god, she walked up to the counter and she went, I've just seen the Constantine movie, you know, and I really enjoyed it. And, you know, I've been sort of doing a bit of research and I was just wondering if you could kind of point me to any of the Alan Moore Hellblazers. And the guy behind the counter, you know what's coming, you know, and this is just, you know, it was a different world, mate, but you know, like the guy behind the counter just went, actually, you'll find that Alan Moore never wrote Hellblazer. He merely introduced the character in the pages. And she just kind of went, just, you know, was taken aback for a second because obviously had never had such terrible customer service in her entire life and then left. And then it was just one of those just moments of like, you just lost 60 quid.
Yeah,
like,
or more.
Yeah, in privilege of that. But you were right. you won. What? It was a weird time, man. I mean, it's so much better now. It's so much better now. So left to kind of go to university and then kind of got back into them. It was one summer and like Marvel Knights started. And that was it. I was back in again with a vengeance, you know, because it was like, you know, I mean, I include sort of Morrison on X-Men as kind of Marvel Knights because it was, you know, it was that ethos kind of spreading out into the whole thing, wasn't it? But you had like Marvel Boy and you had Ennis on Punisher and you had, you know, Quezada and Smith on Daredevil and it was just great, you know, just great. And then I was back. Every time I think I get out, they drag me back in.
That's a spot on Harrison Ford impression, by the way.
That was my Alan Pacino.
Oh, was that Al Pacino?
That was my Alan Pacino.
Well, with that bit of steer in.
On that bombshell.
I'll show myself out and just like slide under the table with
embarrassment. No, I'm cringing. I'm cringing.
No, so right, on that kind of, on the idea of like getting dragged back into it, are there any current comic book runs that you're enjoying at the moment?
Loads, man. Loads. It would be churlish of me not to mention my studio mates. So, I mean, I think everything Ram V and Dan Waters and Ryan O'Sullivan are doing, I think, is pretty special. I'm going to be very careful now that I don't give anything away. But, yeah, I think, you know, I mean, Ram on Swamp Thing, I think, is extraordinary.
Loving that so far.
Yeah. Yeah, Dan's Homesick Pilots, I think, is a revelation. I keep saying to him and Casper, you know, I'm genuinely angry that I didn't come up with that. It's really irritating. I'm just hoping I get to invited to, you know, a party where nobody knows anything about comics and I could just take credit, you know. A Dark Interlude, you know, the sort of sequel to Fearscape. I think, you know, what Ryan's doing, I mean, it's a comic as a troll, you know, but such a beautifully eloquent Nabokovian troll, you know. I just think it's great. I love everything Vitor Ayala's doing. They're a good friend. But, you know, I think shaking everything up. I mean, I think like the X-Books kind of on block at the moment are kind of on fire. Since they've sort of adopted that sort of writer's room. It's going to be interesting, actually, to see if that sort of writer's room framework starts spreading elsewhere. I mean, I get the sense. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm not privy to any of these discussions, but I think, you know, now that, like, DC's got, you know, you haven't got a Superman office anymore, you've got a Metropolis office, you haven't got a Batman office anymore, you've got a Gotham office. And I think that's almost a sort of similar sort of principle, you know, in the sense that it's all very, it's getting very TV writer's room, which is, you know, and you know, funny enough, like, I mean, you know, I can kind of, this is, this, it is a digression, but, you know, I think people kind of instinctively think that that's a kind of quite an artificial framework, but having, you know, sat in one of them last year, like, they're great, man. Like, it's just, you know, a group of, you know, it's not competitive at all. Like, I was in, I hope he doesn't mind me saying, but like, I very briefly sat in on the Lucifer writer's room. And like, they're, you know, they're all, you know, it's like a room of sort of, you know, 10 or 12 of these people, but, you know, they're all kind of pitching in, and it's this really sort of, you know, creatively kind of fecund environment, and, you know, very caffeinated and everything. But then, you know, at the end of every day, they set aside half an hour to kind of help each other out with their spec screenplays and stuff. It's great. It's just a really, really nice system. Yes. It's, whereas I think, you know, in comics, it's much more kind of, I think it's that there's much more of a kind of auteur mentality that isn't necessarily, that I think, you know, that ex office might be kind of breaking down a bit now, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, loads, basically. I think, yeah. The question was, what runs am I enjoying at the moment? So many, basically. I mean, this is going to sound churlish because of just what I'm doing, but, like, I mean, Immortal Hulk, I think, is just one of, if not the best Marvel title in the last 20, 30 years. I just think it's extraordinary.
I really enjoyed the start of that run. I thought it was, like, such a subversion of expectations.
Well, like, Al is saying something really, he's saying something really vital and important about violence at a time of rising violence. You know, it's everything that you kind of, and it's, you know, and not to put too fine a point on it, man. Like, you know, that to me is Marvel to its bones. You know, it's the world outside your window. That's the whole point of Marvel, right? And you know, he's delivering, you know.
Absolutely, like, he's killing it on that. It's definitely been one of the best books, as you say, the last couple of decades. It's so good, and the art on it is amazing as well. Like, everything about it is just quality stuff. But now that you're kind of got your foot in the door at Marvel, so to speak, like, how are you finding that? Is it, like, you obviously grew up reading a lot of Marvel? Is it intimidating, or are you just loving it?
Both. I guess. I don't know that I've got my foot in the door, right? I mean, in the sense that it's, you know, I hope I do. You know, yeah, I like everyone that I've spoken to.
Through the window is the option. You get the foot in the door. You're intensely just looking.
Longingly, yeah. It's the Conan O'Brien gift, yeah. Every experience I've had with them has been, you know, and I'm not just saying this, you know, because there's the shepherd's crook, but genuinely they're, it's a funny one, man. Like, you know, I said around about the time when I was doing those tie-ins, it's such an, I won't choose my words carefully, but I don't mean this in a sort of synthetic sense, but it is such an incredible machine. Marvel machine is just extraordinary. It's the, you know, I agreed to do the book because obviously I would have done, you know, would you be interested? Yes, I would. Thank you very much. Please let me bite your hand off. And then within a week, I was doing it, and it was absolutely, like, Fordist in the way it was kind of produced. But in the sense that, like, they would always kind of come back and go, look, is this artwork okay? Is this what you meant? And it was all very kind of iterative. It wasn't like, you know, you finish the script and then you sort of, you know, you put it on a boat and it goes downstream and you never see it again until it's on the stands. You know, they come back to you, but it's all scheduled and built in the way that, you know, I mean, I come from kind of indie world where, you know, I mean, I'm the bane of letterers. Like, letterers rightly hate me, I'll tinker with that shit until the day before it goes to print, you know, maybe the hour before it goes to print, just because I'm a really unhappy, peculiar man. I like to think I'm a perfectionist, right? I'm not comfortable putting something out in the world unless I think it's really good. So, you know, I'll tinker until someone stops me or shouts at me or presents me with a big bill. And I mean, you can't do that with Marvel. So, you know, the script that you write kind of has to, you know, because if you then turn around and go, by the way, I'm just, you know, I'm on the lettering pass, I'm going to rewrite the whole thing, not going to fly. You know, they've signed off on a script and it has to broadly reflect that, right? So it was a different way of working. It's a much quicker way of working.
The way they still do it, excuse me for interrupting there, like the Marvel method, is that a thing, or was it full script, or sorry, just interesting to see how that goes.
Do you know what it was, I mean, I hope I don't mind, like, I
be careful that the clip track is near you.
it was odd because there was one bit where and you know, they weren't horrible about it or anything, but I was misinformed, because I think again, it depends where the kind of tolerances are, right? So I had this fight scene to script, and someone that I knew who'd done a lot of work for them just said, oh, you know, like, the artists really like to be given a lot of free rein, so just, you know, put in some kind of placeholders, you know, these beats kind of hit, and then, you know, send it that. So basically I did it sort of almost kind of half and half, where it was, you know, all the sort of dialogue intensive scenes were full script, and then all the fight scenes were just, hey man, you know, go crazy. I got a note back basically just going like, no, we prefer you to script the whole thing. And, you know, they weren't horrible about it, but it was just, no, you know, we expect full script. Because then, but it did kind of make sense to me, because, like, you know, you're paid by the page. So, you know, if you just kind of go like, you know,
do your thing.
Iron Fist beats up Sabretooth, do your thing, 5 pages. Thanks very much. Can I have some money now? I mean, I can imagine how, you know, that wouldn't sit very well.
You know. People smashing through buildings. Just like, yeah. Just in different areas.
But no, I mean, every time I've worked with them so far, I mean, I've worked with them on 3 occasions now, and I'm with different editorial teams, and you really do see why they are where they are in the industry, the prominence that they have. Like, it's such a well-oiled machine, and it is genuinely, like, I mean, yeah, you know, hand to God, I mean this, like, just a joy to work with them, you know. I hope there's more.
Well, while we're still on the topic of Marvel, so obviously we've mentioned it several times now, talking about how you have the one shot coming up. So are you writing that with Al Ewing? Are you splitting writing duties with him, or is it just by yourself, or how is it working out at Marvel with that kind of that one shot?
It's co-plotted with Al, and I wrote it. So, although I did notice on previews, I'm credited as Moore, which was very flattering. I am etc.
Is that one of those things of, like, hopefully on a single issue it will come up and be like, your name there?
Oh, no. I mean, no. In the issue, it's all kind of coached. I think to be honest, it's just the kind of credit system they have. But I was just kind of looking at it, and like, my dad just kind of rang me and went, I didn't know you changed your name. I was like, what? Because yeah, you're more. Okay. But, you know, but we also have, I mean, there's a backup in the book as well, by David Vaughan, screenwriter. Really, really good stuff. I mean, I don't know if I can tell you who the artist is on that, but it's a big artist that they've managed to rope in for that. So, you know, it's a group effort, that thing. But yeah, but my story, the front feature is I co-plotted it with Al. I mean, basically, I mean, the way it came about was a bit weird, really, because I mean, Al's a good mate, and I kind of, we got talking about his run just sort of thematically, right? And I was kind of, you know, I come from sort of quite an academic, I come from an academic background. So I was just sort of, we were just sort of chatting it out, and I was just basically saying, oh man, like, there's a lot of stuff I think in your book about or in Immortal Hulk about kind of, you know, like sacred violence and scapegoating and sort of, you know, the sacrificial sort of function of violence. And he just seemed really kind of interested. And then I don't quite know how it happened, but like by the end of the phone call, we sort of had a story. It was really weird. We just sort of, we sort of went like theme in. And then, but I was just kind of saying to him, like, you know, the really interesting thing about your kind of Green Door continuity is that for the first time, you're not bound to the gamma bomb as the first source of gamma mutates. You can have it whenever you want with the Green Door. You can have it whenever you want, just any presence of gamma, and you can have a gamma mutate. So we started, and I think when I pitched it to him, when it sort of started to coalesce, I was thinking of it as almost like a sort of like a commandy sort of thing. You know, I was thinking of it like a sort of far, far future, you know, everything sort of collapsed post, you know, post-lapsarian, you know, sort of Mad Max, you know, bumscape kind of thing. And it was Al actually who just kind of turned around and went, well, why don't you just do the first Hulk? You'd let me do that. And he was like, well, if I could swing it, yeah, of course.
A lot of pressure, but he, wow.
I mean, generosity, I mean, was the thing that I was going to say. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, he's basically, I mean, that's the weird thing, because he was just, you know, it's such a weird, it's very rare, I think, and that you get to do anything, particularly sort of, you know, if you haven't done a huge amount for a company to be, you know, because it was, you know, we didn't know that we were going to get the green light on this until a few months ago. And it was, you know, it had been sort of, you know, percolating, you know, I think Will Moss and Sarah Brunstad have been thinking about it for a while and sort of running it by CB and Tom. But it's a genuinely kind of additive thing. I think that's the exciting thing about this one shot for me is, you know, we're introducing, and I'm not giving you the sales pitch. This is, you know, I'm genuinely excited. It's, you know, it's a new Hulk that you haven't seen before. And, you know, this is my third one shot for Marvel, and I'm basically just creating a new character.
I mean, that must make a massive difference.
Really excited.
Like before using, like, is it Swordsmaster and Celestial Messiah, who were both kind of pre-existing Marvel characters, and then you're basically, as you said, creating one from scratch. Like, that it must be crazy. Like, just the idea of, like, oh, this is my piece of Marvel that now exists.
I mean, it's weird in the sense that, like, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, it can be retconned with a flash, you know. I mean, I've got a vague sense of what's going to happen with Hulk, you know, when Al finishes his run. So it could, you know, just disappear. But by the same token, you know, it could be, because I mean, a lot of the time, I think, you know, particularly within the sort of MCU, I think they've got, you know, Kevin Feige's got a very good instinct. In terms of sort of finding these weird, obscure little corners of the Marvel universe and actually kind of, you know, making it quite, you know, you never know what's going to happen, basically. You know, someone might sort of refer, that, I mean, you know, even, you know, Empire, right? I mean, you know, the Celestial Madonna saga was like this, you know, weird blitz. You know, my dad, you know, that was one of the weird things when I started writing it was, you know, the first person I went to was my dad, because that was his era. And you know, like Engelhart Avengers is like his era, so I was kind of picking my dad's brain, and he was kind of, you know, going through and just digging it all out for me. Yeah, it's great, you know, and right, you need this and this, but actually there's a couple of issues of West Coast Avengers where they go back to the Priest of Palmer's temple in blah, and you really need to bring that. It was fantastic, you know. And I just did this, like, you know, I was just reading stacks and stacks and stacks of old comics in order to kind of get this sort of, you know, firm in my head. But to do something like this, I think from whole cloth is, yeah, I mean, there's pressure. Because, you know, I mean, I think it's additive, but it's a weird one, right? In the sense that I think what we're doing is kind of conceptually additive. I think if people read it with Al's run, you know, I think it's going to be like a nice foil for it. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I could be wrong, I don't know. It depends how well or badly it's received. But you know, the intention is very much to kind of make it feel kind of a piece with the main book as possible. You know, at least, you know, in terms of its themes and stuff.
Sorry, Massimo, I thought you were coming in there.
No, I thought you were done, Alan. Sorry about that.
All yours.
Perfect. So, on the kind of side of the first Hulk, are you allowed to tell us if it has a name? So, like, similar to She-Hulk, Abomination, Red Hulk, is it just going to be called the first Hulk? Are you able to? Is the man with the Disney ears behind the camera cycling across?
But I'd like to think about it. I mean, I've got them myself, haven't I, really? I don't know whether this will be canon, but in the script we refer to it as Ur-Hulk. You are Ur-Hulk.
Yeah. Like fascist or...
Yeah, as in like the kind of thing. I mean, there's a weird little pun there as well, because, like, I think, you know, you've got the city of Ur as well, that was kind of, you know, Mesopotamian, and this is set also in in the sort of epipaleolithic Levant, so it's set in Jordan in sort of 9 to 10,000 BC. Sort of just around the same, just around the time that, because I mean, I can tell you this sort of like as an overarching. I can't tell you anything specifically about it, but, you know, in terms of sort of what we were talking about, kind of conceptually, if you're interested, one of the things that we were sort of discussing, Al and I, was just this idea that the Hulk is not uncivilized. The Hulk is, he is, if you like. Civilization's straw man, if you like. So if you think about the Banner Hulk, right? This is a guy who, the Banner Hulk is a product of military excess, right? He is an absolute product of militaristic excess. And yet, he is hounded by the same military that created him. But think about it, right? What must happen to, Stark Industries stocks every time there's a Hulk song? What must happen to, like, Blackguard Security Services stocks on Wall Street every time there's a Hulk sighting? He's perfect. You fire bullets at him, you'll never kill him. But you can. It's someone to aim ordnance at to basically justify defense budgets, right? He's absolutely part of that system. And we were just sort of saying about how, you know, in terms of sort of scapegoating, that's also the function of the scapegoat, is the thing that civilization cannot tolerate, but needs in order to exist, because it's the thing that you externalize the aggression, you externalize the rage, and you give it a focus, and that's the thing that you can then sort of say, this is the unacceptable thing that we must hunt down. But in reality, you can't ever hunt it down, because you need that in order for civilization to continue, right? In order to police the boundary. I mean, there's that wonderful line there in Blade Runner 2049, you know, civilization is built on a wall. And, you know, one of the things that Al and I were kind of discussing, I think, you know, at least sort of thematically in terms of how we sort of conceptualize the Hulk, is that the Hulk has to exist on the outside of that wall, but he also preserves what's inside the wall, because, you know, it's the, you know, there's the scarecrow, you know, there's the thing that you have to hunt. And so, one of the reasons why this sort of book came about was, you know, just through those discussions, just saying, well, you know, that means that, you know, with the Green Door continuity in place, there will have been a need for Hulks for as long as there's been civilization. And so that sort of led us immediately back to, well, you know, you go back to the cradle of civilization, you go back to the Levant, you go to, you know, Jordan, Palestine, Israel, Syria, you know, right back at the sort of, you know, when you've still got nomadic tribes, you know, harvesting, you know, wild rye and going, oh, you know, maybe we should just build permanent settlements, you know, it's set around that time. Because, you know, the argument that we're kind of making is that there would have been a need for this sort of, you know, the wild man on the periphery. There would have been that need even then.
I see an ongoing sort of book about this. I've got to be honest, like, you've got me completely sold on this whole concept. I'm into it.
I was going to say, yeah, I'm blown away by the fact.
I'm sitting here going, yeah, go on, uh-huh, keep going. And then what happens?
Yeah. But you get 20 pages of that, so hopefully
you're telling me.
I mean we get in and out, and we told the story that we wanted to tell. But I mean, I will say I've given it kind of everything, you know, in the sense that it's a funny one, man. Like, I mean I didn't know whether, you know, because obviously, you know, there's a whole sort of, and you know, I've absolute respect for them, you know, there's a whole kind of, you know, there's a whole Hulk audience out there that wants a big green guy to like smash tanks, and like I'm one of them. I love that stuff too. But I thought with this one, like, you know, if I'm treating this as a discrete thing, I might as well kind of throw the kitchen sink at it. So basically, like, I mean, it's, and I swear I'm not feeding you a line. Like, I just sat down with it and I was like, okay, I don't know if I'm going to get any more work with Marvel. So, and luckily, I mean, you know, it's what I did with the last ones as well. I mean, I think it's a good attitude to have sort of in you know, and I just said, okay, I'm just going to leave nothing in the tank. I'm just going to write the absolute kind of best Hulk story that I possibly can, and see what happens. Anyway, like, I sent the script to Will and Sarah, and came back, you know, 2 days later and said, oh, yep, great. We love this. No notes. So everything nice in the book. I didn't try and do any kind of, you know, continuity kind of winking or anything like that. I just played the whole thing as straight as I possibly could. And, you know, they loved it. I mean, I you never know. I mean, I'm still getting art in now. I mean, I wish I could show you some of it, because it's, you know, Juan is incredible. I really do. But I just hope that what's in my head has made it onto the page. Do you know what I mean? I hope it wasn't too rough a kind of voyage. You know what I mean?
Listening to what you're saying just now, like, I was excited for it, and now the levels have just went crazy. So I really, really can't wait to see what you've done, because it sounds as if it's going to be some book, like, no question about it.
Oh, thanks, man.
Like I said at the start, big fan. Like, everything that you've written that I've read, I've loved each one more than the last, almost. I've not read everything, but like, what I've read is really good. Who would be next on your list? Like, if Marvel say, well, everyone loved that Hulk book, who do you want to work on? Like, if you were given the keys to the kingdom, so to speak, like, who would you take?
Two. Sleepwalker. I know what's happening with Hulk, and I'm as excited for that as anybody. Sleepwalker. I've got a Sleepwalker thing that will absolutely kill. And Madrox.
Also a cool character. Love a bit of Madrox.
Yeah, I mean, I love Match Mini, but I love, you know, Match Multiple Man series is great. I mean, I've got quite a, it's a weird one. Like, I mean, I don't know if I could make it. I think it would work with the Krakoa stuff. I've got a take on it that I think would work with the Krakoa stuff. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure. I mean, like, you know, I mean, I know quite a few people in that writer's room, and I do occasionally. So, anything with Jamie happening?
Just poke a little bit, you know.
You got Spurrier now.
Is he a heater?
To two Brits now. Well, okay. Probably not. No, it's quite pathetic. I remember. Oh man, I've also I will tell anyone. If anyone ever kind of says to me, like, so what's the Madrox idea? It's generally one of those things where I'll, like, you know, I'll get a drink and I'll be like, right. So, and then you're there for the next 3 hours. I just think that's a phenomenal character. And I think Sleepwalker, like, yeah, there's a take on that character that would kind of open up a whole new corner of the Marvel Universe that I would love to do. But, yeah.
I'm so glad you said, sorry, the delay here again. So glad you said two kind of more off the wall characters, because, you know, a lot of times it would be like, who would you want? Wolverine or, you know, Spider-Man? Like, who doesn't like Wolverine and Spider-Man? But you could do so much more with characters like Sleepwalker or Madrox, even. Like, Madrox is established, but you could definitely come off the own thing, right? Like, it doesn't have to appear in 14 different other books that month. And Sleepwalker, when's the last time anyone did anything with Sleepwalker? I don't even remember. So, yeah, I would love to see that as well.
I think it was a Secret Warps, wasn't it? There was a mini, but yeah, it's there's a lot to that kind of. I don't know. It's a funny one though, with the characters that maybe aren't as kind of prominent, because. I mean, I always kind of assume that, you know, a lot of these companies, you know, they want to sort of have them sort of, you know, revivified and I mean, I use the term advisedly, but like made franchisable. But I think there's also a sort of element that, like, you know, if you're sort of coming in, like, they do want you to kind of turn around and go, well, you know, what do you want to do? Well, I want to do Thor. You know, they want to hear that as well. Because, I mean... It, it's a really funny one. Like, I think, you know, we're so what Alan Moore did with Swamp Thing, I think, is so canonical that I think there's a sort of assumption that that's kind of how it's done, that you come in and you take a second or third tier character and you fundamentally rethink them, you know, you reconceptualize them and you push it out and it becomes this enormous success. The reality is that doesn't happen very often. You know, more often than not, you know, there's an attempt and, you know, oh, well, you know, we rolled the dice, didn't quite work. Or you kind of attach a load of star power to it and then it maybe doesn't work as you kind of go along. But I think it's a weird one, because I think and I think this actually plays into what Al did with Immortal Hulk, actually, right? I talked to Rahm about this a lot, right? Because, you know, obviously Rahm's doing Swamp Thing. And it's what Moore did in the anatomy lesson is really interesting in the sense that it was non-invasive. And by that, I mean, he didn't retcon anything that Len Wein and Bernie Wrightson had done. If you read that issue, it's absolutely incredible. If you go back and reread it, he's not retconned a single thing. All he's done is recontextualize it. He said, okay, everything that you've seen is absolutely canon. It's absolutely there. I'm not going to do violence to that in any way. They're the creators that came before me. I respect them. Nothing that you have seen is out of continuity, but this thing was happening as well.
I think that's great, though. Like
the whole way, it's completely non-invasive, and it's a funny thing where I think, you know, that sometimes I think I think the idea that, you know, in order to kind of rejuvenate something, you have to retcon it. No, I think the real skill is not doing any violence to anything that's kind of come before, but just saying, but have you considered looking at it like this? You know, you're holding a different facet of the crystal up to the light, you know?
Different interpretation rather than complete retcon, which I feel like is lost in some of kind of modern comics, is retcon this, retcon that, rather than making sure that stuff is canon, but as you said, taking on a completely different view on it. And I feel like that if you were to write books like that for Marvel, I feel like it would be the ultimate goldmine of just this untapped potential that kind of has almost been lost, I'd say, in recent years with the company-wide reboots that have kind of come into existence.
I mean, look, it kind of reminds me of Starman. Sorry, like, do you remember Starman, the James Robinson book?
Oh,
he takes everything, yeah. Puts it in, and it's like my favourite book of all time, almost. Like, it's up there anyway, and that is like the reason why, because he didn't go, forget that, it's not your daddy's Starman. He went, no, you've got your daddy's Starman, you've got your uncle's Starman, but here's your Starman. And then they then gave the next generation their Starman as well. And it was just like, they all worked together. It was so perfect. Sorry, just get pure excited.
The whole thing was complete. No, the whole thing was kind of, no, I mean, I love that book too. You know, it's the, I think, in fact, I mean, I've got plenty of runs in trade, but that's the only full run I've got in singles. The only one. You know, the rest of them are all sort of on bookshelf. But yeah, but I've got a proper like long box full of the Robinson Starman, the Robinson Harris Starman.
So good.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But like, even like, you know, he revisits. Well, another thing I loved about that book, sorry, just to nerd off, but like, I love how like it just like walked that line between like DCU and Vertigo and never quite decided which one it fell on. Do you remember? It's like, well, we're going to do like, you know, when he goes into space, we're going to go to like the My Blue Heaven Swamp Thing world. And, you know, we're going to throw in, you know, we're going to do a crossover with Sandman Mystery Theater, because why wouldn't we? And also we get to work with Guy Davis, who's a genius. So that's brilliant. But we're also going to do Superman. You know, I loved how, and it was the only one, wasn't it, that was kind of allowed to just sort of be both. It was sort of a Vertigo book, sort of a DC book. I love that.
Obviously not dragging it away.
That's amazing.
Comics too much. But I was going to say, so like, we were talking about education earlier on, and you graduated with a PhD in English literature from Lancaster University. With your dissertation, Anywhere But Here, The Competing and Complementary Postmodern Nostalgias of J.G. Ballard and Douglas Copland. Okay, so I know that was about
the Jesus Christ, though, yeah.
But has the idea of like nostalgia as a concept influenced your own writings? The idea of looking back on, because I know you talked about like kind of Starman looking back and bringing these concepts in towards kind of the same continuity in the canon. Has that influenced your own writing and when you've been writing your own stories or like other characters like kind of from Marvel and stuff? Or even Doctor Who as well?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think like the first arc of the first story I did in Doctor Who, the one that, you know, where you've got this sort of, you know, this character called the Wayfarer that Simon Fraser, I subsequently found out, intentionally drew as a giant penis. I opened it up, I was like, man, that looks like a giant penis. And I saw him at New York Comic Con. I was like, you know, that looked like a giant penis. And he just looked at me and went, But like, didn't confirm or deny, but there was a smile. Barrow's called the Wayfarer. And the idea is that it separated entropy from time, so time became space, and basically you had an invasion of the present by a load of militarized hippies who basically want a never-ending Woodstock.
But that was all
stuff really from the sort of the research that I'd done into like restorative nostalgia. You know, I mean, I think the funny thing is, I mean, I did that thing, you know, 10 years ago, and now it's become, I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, through not through my work, but through the work of many, many other, I mean, like the sort of whole hauntology movement, I think, has been sort of quite integral to sort of, you know, the sort of adoption of sort of nostalgia in sort of mainstream discourse and sort of speaking about it in terms of its relation to like the uncanny and like sacred violence and stuff like that. But, you know, this idea that like nostalgia is a precursor to violence. And I think we've seen that, right? I mean, that's exactly it, right? Like, we tend to think of nostalgia as a very sort of benign kind of fuzzy feeling, but actually, you know, it's I mean, don't get me wrong. I know Scotland has a very different relationship to nationalism than England. You know, English nationalism, I think, is no. You know, Scottish nationalism, as far as I can tell, is civic nationalism. It's about the future. It's about what you can do to make the lives of the people better. But my interpretation of English nationalism is that it's fundamentally regressive. It's all about it's a stabbed in the back. It's driven by a sense of grievance over loss of empire, and is unbelievably toxic, unbelievably dangerous, and I'm sure it's going to get us into a lot of trouble. So that's going to be fun. But that's all couched in nostalgia, you know. That's all, you know. It was funny, you know, because I mean, I did that PhD, you know, mainly on Ballard, and it was interesting doing it because, you know, Ballard was, you know, he grew up in a concentration camp in Shanghai. You know, he was put into a Japanese internment camp, and he said, you know, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, the thing that demonstrated to him was, you know, he went from sort of, you know, being in a very sort of civilized, you know, area of Shanghai region, but that, you know, was full of kind of English architecture. And then just, you know, a week later saw people being sort of, you know, hanged from lampposts with electrical wire. And he said it seemed to him that, like, you know, reality was a stage set that could be sort of folded away like a game of chess at any moment. And when he came to England, you know, he just pathologized the English instantly. You know, he moved into Shepperton and was like, these people are fucking crazy. Like, you know, all of the kind of the suburban manners. And, you know, I mean, we're quite, I think, accustomed to the idea of sort of, you know, disturbia now, of like the suburbs as a site of kind of psychopathy and weird wife swapping and, you know, kind of odd pathologies, you know. But at the time, that was kind of revelatory. You know, but
your one shot for TKO there, what was it called again? The single issue? That, like,
you know exactly where that everything came from.
Yeah, so good. Like, I love that. Like, amazing, amazing story. Sorry, just when you were saying that, I was like, oh, this is talking about that. I was just reading about that, sorry.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That's exactly where it came from. It was, I've, you know, if nothing else, I mean, I cannibalize that PhD all the time for everything, you know. the last time I devoted any.
I was going to say, should we call you doctor? Is that a thing we should call you doctor?
Oh, Jesus Christ! Please don't. Please don't.
I was having a conversation with my mum, and she said, "The way if you put a doctor at the start of his name, he sounds almost like a supervillain. Like it's like."
I mean, oh Jesus, yeah, no. Oh, thanks for that.
Well, at least your PhD went. It's not.
I think like I sound like one of those. I definitely sound like an evil doctor, don't I? I mean, there's definitely sort of like, you know. It's on the, you know, Patnodel sort of on the same sort of Slavic curve as like Kevorkian. Oh, no, that's Armenian, isn't it?
Or,
do you know
what I mean? It's definitely one as well. Zoltano.
What did he do? He took their teeth. Their teeth. anyway.
So how did you go from having a PhD, as we just said, and having a really cool evil doctor name, to working into a digital marketing firm, to then going to work on for several major comic book publishers? Because you were going to mention about how you got into your first gig and stuff like that. Could you tell us about?
Oh yeah, I mean, I do, but it's really kind of banal, like and sort of annoying, but. Yeah, so no, I mean, I got the PhD, moved down to London, and ended up working in a fancy dress shop.
Nice.
ended up working in a fancy dress shop, got sort of
picked up. Like, this guy came in and I ended up working for this digital marketing company. And that was, you know, everything that sort of, you know, the couple of years that I was working for them, that I ended up using all that stuff for Arcadia and Frendo. It was because it was around about sort of 2011. It was when they started to do all that sort of horrible kind of, you know, Cambridge Analytica style sort of micro-targeting. And it was, even at the time, I was kind of going like, this isn't kosher, is it? Ended up sort of, you know, using that. So it was all useful. But in terms of sort of the comic thing, so I still live in Lancaster, but around about 2005, Andy Diggle moved up here. We became friends, and I sort of spent the next 10 years down the pub with him, telling him all my stupid ideas. And it got to a point where, you know, I never wrote anything down. You know, it was always, you know, just trying to be sort of a pub raconteur. And he just shut me down and just went, look, I'm not going to listen to any more of these ideas until you've written them down. And one day, I mean, I don't know what the impetus was. I think it was just, you know, moving back up or whatever, but I did. And he looked at it and we went to Thought Bubble. I think it was Thought Bubble 2014 or 2015, one of the two. And he just plonked me down in front of Will Dennis, who was then the outgoing group editor of Vertigo, and just went, right, talk. And, you know, threw me into the deep end. And of course I made an absolute like fanny of myself. But somehow managed to get through it to the point where Will just kind of went, look, just like, you know, email me. So I sent him what became Arcadia, and he liked it and showed it to Greg Lockhart and Shelley Bond, then at Vertigo. And it was kind of all go. And I just kept, you know, I was just getting like email after email going, right, you know, it's made it past this hurdle. It's made it past this hurdle. And eventually it was like, right, okay, you know, you've gone through Vertigo approvals, you know, you're good to go. We just got to wait for approval now from, you know, the guys out in LA. And so I got out to LA and they shut it down. They're like, yep, no, but here's the thing. You know, I was devastated, right? But Will is such a good guy. So I was sat there kind of, you know, I mean, genuinely, man, like, you know, in despair. I'm there, you know, in my kind of early 30s thinking, that's it, you know, I've sailed too close to the sun, you know, back down the digital marketing mines I go. And then he calls me out of the blue and just goes, all right, yeah, you're gonna get a Skype call from LA in a couple of hours. Because I just, you know, it didn't feel right to me. So like I sent it on to Boom, and Matt Gagnon and Bryce Carlson are gonna call you. I went, what? I mean, yeah, they're gonna call you. Anyway, thanks, bye. And they called, and it was up and running within a couple of hours. And that was my first book. You know, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm starting to feel more like I've kind of paid my dues, but I know so many people who have much more sort of Byzantine and tortuous roots into comics that I always feel. Well, you're just like, you know, like I did like 25 Kickstarters and I sold a kidney. You know, and there's so many people who have kind of stories like that, and you know, really, like, I mean, you know, it's a funny one though, because I mean, I keep coming back to this. Like, I think it was Cy Spurrier who said, you know, or told me. I mean, I don't know where he originated it, but he said, you know, breaking into comics is like breaking out of prison. I said, what do you mean? He goes, it basically every route gets bricked up after you. So, you know, no two routes in are exactly the same. So whenever anyone kind of, you know, beyond, you know, there's the obvious. So, you know, don't be shit is probably good advice.
You heard it here first.
Don't be shit. Don't be horrible to anyone, you know, is probably, you know, good advice as well, you know. but, you know, beyond that, you know, I think, the advice I think is, well, that's what worked for me, but it's probably not going to work a second time. You know, I mean, there's people who do sort of, you know, Marvel internships. I mean, you know, that's how Donnie broke in, wasn't it? You know, Donnie did like a, you know, Marvel internship and then spent years working at Bleeding Cool. And I think, it's very, very different. But like, my path in was like very smooth. I mean, it got bumpy subsequently because I didn't really know what I was doing. It was that thing of, you know, where, you know, you're supposed to have a sort of, I think after the Boom book, you know, I was sort of supposed to have like this roadmap and, you know, I was being very reactive until I kind of met all the kind of White Noise guys. You know, they were the ones who really sort of took me to one side and just kind of went, look, you know, you're kind of chasing your, you know, you can't just do what you're doing. You can't just wait for work. You know, you've got to be a lot more kind of proactive, and that really helped.
So with the White Noise guys, like I say, Ram V, Ryan, everybody, like, yous are all obviously really doing well at the moment. Is there something that yous are going to do together? Are there any plans for like maybe some thing together, or is it all just you're all doing your own thing and just helping each other out?
I can't say too much because it's kind of future plans, but there might be something like that on the horizon, but I'm not involved. And that's not a kind of, we're breaking up or anything. It's just, you know, yeah, we sort of pair. I mean, like Dan and I have done a bunch of stuff together, you know, but we it was like, you know, football tie-in graphic novels and stuff. And, you know, so yeah, I mean, we, you know, we're the sort of first line of editorial for anything we kind of produce. So the books that get put out have all been kind of through the Brainless Trust. and you know, it's been certainly, you know, for my purposes, it's because I mean, I'm not a very structural guy. I don't write particularly to structure. And those guys are very, very kind of structurally focused. And so I tend to find that, you know, although it involves a lot of rewriting on my part, they're always right. And then, you know, you get privy to, you know, you get some nice stuff. So, you know, I mean, a lot of like, you know, Rahm's Justice League Dark arcs, by the way, I'm not claiming any ownership, but, you know, little things here and there that might enhance stuff, right? So, you know, and I'm sat there kind of on a train platform in Kendal at 2 o'clock in the morning, sort of, you know, being a sort of sounding board for, you know, his sort of second Justice League Dark arc. That's I love that stuff. That's the most fun part of the job, you know.
It sounds pretty good to me.
For me personally, it just seems like the ideal, the dream of having so many people who are around you in comics, at the comics.
Well, that's the thing, though. I think it's a weird one because, to sort of loop back, like, I mean, you know, it's such a kind of auteur-focused kind of industry that I don't think it necessarily kind of, it seemed to us like the most sort of intuitive thing in the world, but everyone always wants us to kind of define it, and it's quite a funny thing. It's like, so, you know, so what exactly do you do? And, like, you know, it's hard to sort of say, well, you know, a lot of the time, you know, genuinely, and I'm being perfectly serious, a lot of the time it's kind of, you know, like, drawing bollocks on each other's comic covers and then posting it into a group chat. Like, there's a lot of that. just, you know, it's just idiocy. Exactly. You know, but you know, there's a lot of that. But then, you know, if we've got a problem, it's an excellent forum to just kind of go, look, you know, I'm trying to break story and I've hit this wall. And, you know, and everyone's got their own kind of everyone's got their own kind of approach to it. You know, it's an absolute, certainly for me. I mean, you know, I mean, the moment that ends, you know, I'm shagged. It's such an invaluable resource, you know.
I've read, I don't believe that for a second. Like, your very first book, was this pre, like, Arcadia, would that be pre White Noise? Like, was that before you met the guys, or?
Yeah, but I mean, the thing, I mean, Arcadia was, I mean, if you read it, it's very first book, you know. There's a lot of, you know, I think it's that thing, because, you know, I mean, like, I worship Grant Morrison growing up, and it's that thing of like, well, I've got to have like 15 ideas per page or I'm doing comics wrong. and then just sort of, you know, I think that's the thing. I mean, one of the things I think I've sort of learned in the last sort of, you know, half decade or whatever is a lot of the time is, I mean, you know, others may disagree, but, you know, certainly from my perspective, it's just been like restraint. You know, I like Arcadia. Don't get me wrong. I like it a lot. And I know there are people who like, you know, it's the only thing of mine that they've ever liked. But it was very much, you know, it was my first book and I wanted to sort of, you know, do some backflips, you know, and just, you know, check me out.
When you said earlier on about, you got your first book for Marvel and you were like, oh, it might be the only thing I ever do. So I want to, like, you know, do this, do that. I remember watching the Daredevil DVD back in the day, and it was the documentary with Brian Bendis and Michael Bendis, and he was saying, like, he wrote his first thing and he just threw everything at it. He was like, he says, yeah, I'd like to be like 50 years down the line, like at the bar smoking a cigarette going, yeah, I wrote Nick Fury one time, it was great. Like, they never let me back anywhere near it, but it just, I had to make sure I got Nick Fury in there and Elektra and whatever else. So it sounds to me as if that's everybody's go-to thing, like, right away. It's just like, get everything in, you want to say as much as possible because it might never happen again.
Oh man, like that the Swordsman one shot that I did, you know, I contrived a way to have a page of Captain America and Iron Man. Of course I did.
You got it right. Like, if you give it the chance.
But when in Rome, right? Yeah, exactly, absolutely. Yeah, right?
You chop at the bit, that's it.
And then, but then, like, it was weird, man, because, like, that came out, and then, like, a load of, like, you know, I mean, they were so cool about it, but like, a load of, like, Cap Iron Man shippers kind of cottoned onto it and we're like taking screen grabs and like, oh my god, it's happening.
Look,
yes,
what you've done.
That's fantastic. I loved it.
Oh man. So see, when we're on the kind of idea of writing stuff like Arcadia that is yours, like kind of the stuff you write, and then stuff that you write for Marvel that is kind of like kind of corporate stuff, is there like a nostalgia or attachment you feel to an original idea versus something that they give to put in front of you? Or are all the stories that you write, you have the same kind of attachment to them as a writer?
I mean, you have sort of favorite children, certainly. And I mean, I think I've learned the hard way that I think if you don't do something, if you don't do something that you can sort of find a measure of passion in, you're going to pay for it down the line. But I mean, in terms of, yeah, I mean, the stuff that sort of originated, I mean, you know, it's no effort to kind of manufacture kind of enthusiasm for that, right? You get out of bed and you're kind of eager to do it because it's this thing that you have a kind of compulsion to get on the page. Similarly, I think with, you know, there are, you know, and don't get me wrong, I mean, you know, it's the way it works. I mean, I'm going to be quite candid about it. You know, I have a huge attachment to kind of Marvel and DC. So, you know, anything they kind of put me on, again, I'm feeding my 13-year-old self, and my 13-year-old self is kind of sitting there kind of smothered in chocolate going, more, more. So you know, it's fine. I think, you know, but if it's a property that I'm not that I don't have a particular attachment to, I mean, sometimes it can be like pulling teeth. Like Doctor Who was no problem. Assassin's Creed was an interesting one because, like, I mean, I wasn't particularly a fan of the game, but the moment we started writing Assassin's Creed, what a really interesting thing happened, which is, you know, we tend to, it's no secret that, you know, if you work in what we may for convenience refer to as the creative industries, there's a sort of fear of, there's a definite sort of desire to kind of have a firewall between kind of ourselves and fandom to an extent, because sometimes fandom can be like a lot, you know? But the Assassin's Creed stuff was really interesting because it was additive, right? Don't be wrong, you know, we had like a load of old alt-right wankers, you know, on YouTube saying that we were arseholes, and that's fine. You know, I don't mind being called. Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, it's a badge of honor, isn't it? To be thought of as an arsehole by all that. But in terms of the Assassin's Creed stuff, we just had like a load of these guys who were backfilling the continuity for us. I've never seen anything like it. It was really interesting. They were kind of going, "All right, so this thing that you've just come up with, well, that actually kind of plugs into something in Assassin's Creed 2." And that actually kind of, you know, well, we, you know, that's the kind of pirate continuity. So that's clearly situated there. And they're kind of, it was the most bizarre thing that they're being really friendly, really kind of, you know, all the kind of Ubisoft heads are, they're plugging it into the continuity for you. And you can see all these like wikis kind of happening in the background where they're backfilling it and they're rationalizing it themselves. I've never seen anything like it. It was absolutely amazing. It's just in the end, it was just like, this is fun. Do you know what I mean? I'm just, you're just throwing them these things and they're just kind of going, all right, well, that belongs there, that belongs there, that belongs there. And eventually it becomes a kind of dance. You know, it's great. It was just a really, really positive kind of fan interaction.
Yeah. Just what you said there about like the alt-right and whatnot, like, obviously, it's definitely a badge of honour if they don't like you, right? It's, you're doing something wrong if they're defending you in any way. Like,
but, yeah, pretty much, yeah. Well, no, generally, I think if they're defending you, they just haven't understood you.
Well, yeah, there's that, yeah. Like, that's the only way you're kind of hoping that that happens, right? We were going to ask you about breaking into comics.
I don't know, yeah.
But we've already covered that in our previous things, like you said. The door gets bricked up behind you on the way in, so we're not going to bother with that because you've covered it. So I think we've probably taken a lot of your time.
When I say it's bricked up, I just for anyone, you know, for listeners or viewers, I would just say when I say it's been bricked up, that doesn't mean that there are no routes in. It just means that no two routes in are the same. Of course, you know, go for it. Like, absolutely go for it. I don't want to kind of dissuade anyone from trying because, you know, the more new blood the better, you know.
I think that's a very positive message though you're kind of getting across, that like you can have that thing of that first rejection of Arcadia and then get it picked up again, and like it's almost as Alan would love to say, because I know he loves to say it, it's a Cinderella story. That's his favourite terminology.
It's a rags-to-rags story, but this time I'm choosing to wear the rags. It's just because I'm fucking lazy.
Well,
I really like these pants.
Well, that being said...
You've got to be comfy, especially in this period.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. Alex, it's been an absolute joy to have you on. Thank you for giving so much of your time to us and being able to sit and talk with us. It's been phenomenal. It's been great.
Not at all. Thanks for having me, man.
Before we go, would you like to plug anything else other than the Immortal Hulk one shot that's coming up? Is there anything else that's coming up in your future you might want to plug to the listeners?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay. So I've got a TKO graphic novel out at the moment called Red Fork, which is about it's a sort of cosmic horror set in a mining community. Thanks very much, man. Set in a mining community in West Virginia. Very, very proud of it. I've got another TKO short out called Hand Me Down, which I think you can pick up for about £3, which is just a one shot about a sort of suburban demonic possession that kind of goes horribly wrong. And also through Vault, I've got Giga, which is I'm going to mention it before, but it's a murder mystery set in a world of sort of inhabited giant mechs.
It sounds amazing. I'll be honest.
Drop me a line afterwards. I'll furnish you guys. Apart from that, there's Immortal Hulk: Time of Monsters drops May 19th. Very excited for everyone to read it. Really hope you like it. Sorry I talked too much. Thanks.
Not at all. It's been phenomenal. Thank you so much for giving us so much time. And honestly, the more you talk, the better. It's great. With that being said, this has been the BGCP Disassembled Podcast interview special. And you guys can find us on Twitter at BGCP Comic Con, on Facebook, BGCP Comic Con as well, same name. And if you'd like to check out all the reviews, news, and latest comic book news that's available on the site, that would be very much appreciated as on BGCP Comic Con, the website. So everybody who is listening, have a great day, a great week, and everyone here at the BGCP wishes you very nice messages.